We're in a series entitled Passion, Purity, and Marital Fidelity, and the title of today's message is Passion, Purity, and Engagement. Hopefully you've received the notes in your bulletin. If you need a set of notes, just raise your hand and the ushers will get you a set of notes. Anyone need a set of notes? Well, last week we talked about courtship, and we're going to continue in that same study, and we're going to talk also about how courtship leads to engagement. And what is courtship all about? Well, courtship is the time when you are deciding whether or not the person that you're interested in is someone you would consider marrying. So consider it a time of exploration and discovery in a committed setting with great accountability and visibility. The focus is not on romance. The focus is on whether this person has the character to serve God for the rest of their days with you. This is all about finding out if this is the person that you want to raise generations of children with, though you're not thinking about it in that way at that time. That comes later. You want to focus on a special friendship with this person. If you go into marriage only built on romance, you are going on a rotten bridge. It's like gasoline that you pour on the ground. It lights up very quickly, but then an hour later it's cold. What you need are the long-burning logs of godliness, the new birth, and a relationship and walk with Jesus Christ. If you both have that, the possibility of failure in marriage is very, very minuscule. In fact, I read this week that 1 in 1,000 couples who are both born again and read the Word of God together, 1 in 1,000 end in failure. That's pretty impressive. In courtship, there is a commitment not to go to the romantic side, though you are going to feel those feelings. But there's a commitment to keep your focus in the right place. Because again, love is intoxicating. And if you enter into courtship giving your heart away, you're entering into a very dangerous place. Now, if you have to compromise your purity or your convictions during this time, you know that at the very least you need to put it on hold, and possibly you just need to end it and know when to call it quits on the courtship. Oh, how much better it is to end a courtship than to end a marriage, which God does not permit. And so if you have to compromise, put on the brakes. You don't hitch your wagon to a wild horse. It's not a wagon, though, that you will destroy if you have to compromise your convictions, but it's your life, it's your soul. And so make sure that the person you're considering marrying is faithful, dependable, exemplary, predictable in godliness and convictions, and if this is not that person, then you need to wait. Now we come to the Song of Solomon, chapter 2 and verse 8. Where we see that courtship inevitably leads to marriage. And all the excitement, we can just sense it. It's palpable. Imagine the Shulamite farm girl in her poor little shack of a house. And she says, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills." And she compares him to a gazelle and a young stag. Well, here we see the preparation for marriage is courtship. And during this time, it's a wonderful time to get to know each other. Now, how long should courtship go on? Well, courtship should go very slowly. You should go into courtship very cautiously with the permission of both parents. You should be going into courtship very cautiously concerning your purity. Because as you can see, this girl's heart is aflame. So even before she enters into the courtship, she's got to have lots of people instructing her, around her, helping her to see reality. Now, if you'll turn your notes over, I have there a purity covenant that we've put together. It's just an example. But in 3 weeks from now, I want to be able to give, whoever wants one of these, I want to give any of our young people who would like this, a framed copy of a purity covenant with their name and with parents' signatures and the pastor's signature and their signature on it, that they can hang on their wall and consider their commitment and covenant to God to remain pure until they're married. Because you need to have these commitments ahead of time. You don't go into your car and drive without the lights on at night. How far will that get you? You'll just bang up. Well, this purity covenant is a humble way of trying to turn the lights on to our own passions. You want to know what you're made of? Romans chapter 3 describes what you and I are made of. And it's not pretty. It says that our heart is like an open sepulcher. There's nothing good in our flesh. Nothing in our flesh can please God. You put your flesh into a situation where you're alone with someone of the opposite gender that you are very fond of, you're talking about pouring gasoline on the flesh. And you need to turn the light on to your own depravity. You need to know what you're made of and what you're capable of. And we are all made of the same stuff. In our flesh dwells no good thing. You've got to know that. Turn the light on. Because, as you can see in this verse, passions are strong. Solomon, the king, has become very much infatuated with this Shulamite farm girl, and he can't wait to see her. She describes him as leaping over the mountains and bounding over the hills. All obstacles are easily overcome by love. So courtship is a time where you get to know each other. It's a time of anticipation. And we see the anticipation happening in this passage of Scripture. It's almost breathtaking. The courtship is exhilarating. There are strong words, at least in soliloquy, thought about in their hearts, and strong affections. But this is a good thing. Courtship is a wonderful thing. I want you to turn over to Proverbs 18 and verse 22, because there we find a verse that tells us that the goal in courtship is a good goal. The goal in courtship is a good goal. It says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." And Solomon is leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills, doing exactly that which pleases God. God says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains what? Favor. Grace from the Lord." Listen, you want the Lord in your courtship. Parents, you want the Lord in your children's courtship. You want the Lord's favor. So there's great anticipation, and we need the Lord's help because our emotions sometimes can become overpowering. There's also dedication in courtship. Solomon was committed. And he's seen as overcoming all obstacles, mountains and hills, in order to see this lady. And he keeps saying in this chapter, "Come away, let's spend time together, let's get to know each other." That's a good thing. Now, you may be curious about the word courtship. It's from the Elizabethan era, in which the ladies of the court were wooed and won by knights and lords of the court through a process of frequent visitation. In other words, you've got to spend time together in order to get to know each other. But remember what I said that was always present in Solomon and the Shulamite's relationship. Before marriage, there is always accountability, visibility, and purity. You need to have visibility. You need to be around other people. But you need to have accountability where you're around people that have godly convictions. Because if you're with 1,000 fornicators, they're going to encourage you to fornicate as well. You can have all the visibility that you want. But you need to have accountability of people with the same convictions and purity. Remember, she says, don't awaken love until it pleases. That is, until a marriage covenant is ratified before God and before witnesses. Don't awaken that love because you can't put that fire out. Now, love overcomes all obstacles. If you read 1 Corinthians 13, it always thinks the best. It always fills in the blanks with that which is most positive to the person's character. Love hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 13, it never fails. I'm not talking about infatuation. I'm not talking about romance. I'm talking about self-sacrifice for another. That is what love is. It is self-sacrifice. And so Solomon comes bounding over the mountains and leaping over the hills. And all offenses, these mountains, these hills, are overcome. Do you know the Scripture says in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, love covers all offenses. And in other places it says, love covers a multitude of sins. Isn't that true? Courtship is such a wonderful foundation for marriage if it's done right. Because that's exactly what you're going to need when you get into marriage. If you start nitpicking in marriage, the love embers will quickly grow cold. And let me just say that the responsibility for love in the marriage, primarily, is it the woman or the man? It is the man. Ephesians 5:25 clearly tells us that as men, we are to love our wives as Jesus Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. Now that is an impossible standard to keep apart from the grace of God. And so as men, we cannot complain that our wives do not respect us. Because we must first love our wives as Jesus Christ loves the church. Now, who crucified Jesus? Do you know? See, it was the Jews. It was the Romans. Those who welcomed him with the shouts of Hosanna, just a few days later, put nails in his hands and his feet, and they yelled, "Crucify him! The church crucified Jesus! You crucified Jesus! I crucified Jesus!" And what did Jesus do while he was being crucified? He loved the church, and he gave himself for it. Now, I speak about Christ and the church in the context of marriage. Men, whatever you receive from your wife, whether you feel like you're being crucified, you must love your wife and lay your life down for her. That's what you're depicting. You're depicting the gospel when you react correctly to your wife. Now, interestingly, there is communication, lots of communication. In verse 10, he says, "Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away." The New Testament gives this admonition to husbands, and I think it's good to start this process in the courtship time. 1 Peter 3:7 says, "Dwell with your wife in an understanding way, because your wife is a weaker vessel. You want to be heirs together of the grace of life, and you don't want your prayers to be hindered." There's a lot in that verse. Well, first of all, dwelling with your wife in an understanding way means that you try to understand what she's trying to say. You try to understand what she's trying to communicate to you, which means that you cannot get easily offended by what she's saying. Sometimes she's going to be huffy and puffy, and sometimes it's not going to come out right. And as a man, you need to set the example and speak to her like Solomon intimates here in this verse, verse 10, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. You need to set her at ease. In the courtship process, it's important, not necessarily to use all this romantic language. As I said, in this poem, in this greatest of Solomon's songs, a lot of what is employed is called soliloquy. That is, this is what's going on in his heart and in his mind. Not necessarily what he is saying to this girl. But we understand his sentiment is to provide a safe place where this young lady can express herself and find sweet friendship with Solomon. Husbands, let me just ask you, you're far beyond this courtship process. You are committed for life to this woman. And you may not have done it all the right way. I very rarely do I look out at a church and say that we've all done it the right way. Why? Because many of us were saved in the process, and none of us, hardly any of us, were taught any of this. But isn't it a blessing that our children can hear this? But listen to this. If you do not have a place for your wife, man, where she feels safe and loved to be able to say anything that she wants, then in time, you're going to have a wedge in your marriage if it's not already there. That's why you start these things in the courtship process, founding your relationship on a friendship, not on romance. Because what you need is a godly Christian in marriage. Anybody can be a romantic. But you need someone who is godly, and then you need to set the standard and have a policy of open arms and not condemning anything your wife says. Let her have a place where she can freely speak to you. And you're going to have to communicate this. And you're also going to have to demonstrate through character by not getting angry with what she has to say. So it's going to take some godliness, and that begins in the courtship process. Now there's also affection. She compares her beloved to a gazelle or a young stag. Now those are really amazing comparisons. And, you know, all of us as men, we think, yeah, I'm a young stag, I'm a young stud. And no, that's not exactly what she's saying, okay? What she's saying is this man has much grace and gentleness like a gazelle, but he's strong like a young horse on a mountain. He's got the convictions, and he's got the character, and what the inner strength to protect me, like a young stallion. But he's gentle like a gazelle. That's what a man is. If you're not like that man, you're not a man, you're less than a man. If you have the strength of a stallion, but you use it instead of protecting your bride or protecting your intended, you lash out at her, then you're less than a man. You need to use these arms not to lash out, or your voice, not to lash out at the one you love. You need to use these arms to lash out at anyone who would want to harm her. We're to protect like a young stallion, but be graceful as a gazelle to her. And so there's strength and gentleness. And there's great affection. Look at this, verse 10 or verse 9. Behold, there he stands behind our wall. She's speaking of the wall of her mother's house. Remember, her father's not on the scene. There he stands, she can see him coming, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. So in courtship, there is a great affection. There's a great desire to be with one another. And that's good. And often you'll know when young people are courting, they'll want to be together all the time. And if they can't be together, they want to be on the phone together. And if they can't be on the phone together, they want to text each other. And if they can't text each other, they want to be on Facebook. And they're obsessed. Now, that's a good obsession. It's all right. God put it there. You're to have an unbreakable bond. That's what you're working towards. But let me just say this. Courtship is not the time to fast forward the process. So be careful about these desires to be with each other day and night. You need to limit your time together. 3-4 hours a week during the courtship time. Now, during the engagement time, it's not a slow process. I recommend short engagements and stay very, very busy. But again, don't be alone. The greatest temptation in engagement is to think, well, I'm going to marry this girl, so why can't I have her body? You know why? Because it's fornication, and God says that God will judge whoremongers. And why in the world would you take a woman who you say you love and treat her like a prostitute for your own temporary pleasure? Let's paint it like it is. Men, how should we deal with pornography? How should porneia, which includes premarital sex, as well as looking at wrong things on the internet, as well as magazines, porneia, pornography, how do we deal with it? There ought to be a hatred in your heart for it. A hatred. You ought to think, if you ever have a thought like that, the way you put it down, you cast it down. And the way you do that, you think about that girl not as an object, but as a human being. And you think about that girl's father. And you think about one day that girl's going to stand before God and she's not ready. Oh God, please let this girl find some clothes. And let this father find some convictions. And let this girl find salvation. And move on with your hatred towards this kind of stuff. Now, Solomon is keen at wanting to be with this girl. And these are intimations for the trouble. There's a desire for her to come away. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But let's also consider that there is great hope in courtship. There's great renewal. Everything seems in life to be going well when you're in love. No matter what's happening. When you're in love, you're just floating along in life. And this is intimated in verses 11 through 13. We read, "For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land, the fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. It's springtime again." I want you to realize that courtship is, in this sense, wonderful preparation for marriage. Now, when you get into marriage, there's going to be struggles. There's going to be difficulties. But you always ought to be renewing your love for one another in marriage, for you married people, constantly renewing your love for each other. And you ought to experience a revival and a renewal and a hope on a regular basis, just like in your spiritual life. You need that renewal, that renewing of your mind on a constant basis. It's not that you need to get saved again. You just need to renew your devotion to Christ and consecrate yourself. In the same way, as married people, we need to constantly renew that springtime of love in our life. You should always be on your honeymoon. But this comes easy for young people. But it's not always that easy. Some young people make a mistake by not heeding warning signs. And they think that they can just plow right forward without looking carefully at whether they should be married to this person or not. I know of a courting couple who allowed themselves to be in tempting situations. And they started fooling around because they did not have people of the appropriate convictions around them, or they found themselves alone on a regular basis. And while they did not consummate anything, they came very close. And so, without having had time to develop a good friendship and a godliness, and to find out if this person has the right character. They went right into marriage without any of that, thinking that it's better to get married than to burn. Now, that is true. It is better to get married than to burn. But if that's all you found a marriage on, you are in deep trouble. And that couple today is divorced, sadly. Now, it doesn't always end that way. Wherever there is the grace of God, God can change hearts. But do not found your marriage on romance alone. I've heard of couples getting married because it's a quick way out of their parents' home. That's a bad idea. Number one, you don't want to begin your marriage by breaking the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother. Now, maybe you did that, and you need to understand that once you're married forever. No matter how your marriage started, you have got to grasp for the grace of God. Because whatever God has joined together, man should not separate. There are those who can't get along very well as a couple. And they have all kinds of highs and lows. And they don't seem to be doing very well in courtship, so they just decide, well, maybe marriage will just help us. We'll be able to be together. Maybe we'll get to know each other more. And so they go right into courtship. I mean, from courtship right into marriage. Engagement and marriage. And they get into that marriage. And if they couldn't lift a 50-pound dumbbell, they certainly aren't going to lift a 350-pound dumbbell. There's no way. You see, you go from the fire, frying pan right into the fire. We got to look at the warning signs. If the person is not of a godly character, if there is a need to compromise your convictions in order to go forward with this person, you need to put on the brakes and have the character enough to say stop. But secondly, not only do we see a preparation for marriage, we see a proposal for marriage. Look at verse 13 and 14 of chapter 2. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. O, my dove, in the cleft of the rocks, in the crannies of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. This is the closest thing to a proposal we have in the Song of Solomon. What he's saying is, like a dove who hides in the protection of the crannies of the rocks and the mountains. You need to come out of those mountains and come into my protection. And that is exactly what a proposal for marriage is. It's asking the girl to be married, to come out of the protection of her home, of her father and of her mother, and to come into your protection. And so engagement is a promise to marry. Betrothal in the Bible times is the closest thing that we have to engagement. It was much more of a binding covenant than engagement is. If we break an engagement, that's fine. It's better to break an engagement than to go in on the wrong premises into marriage. But in the Bible times, breaking a betrothal was breaking a covenant, and it was akin to divorce. It was taken very seriously, and it was made between two families. And I think we should follow at least some of what was in the betrothal idea. Both families need to give the green light before an engagement can go forward. Now, in this betrothal, there would be a ceremony, even though the wedding's a ways off. The groom-to-be would give a ring or some other signification of his intention. And they would document that he was wanting to marry her. He was promising to marry her. And he would say something like this to her, "See, by this ring you are set apart from me according to the law of Moses and of Israel." Pretty serious. And so, engagement, in the same way, is a promise to marry that girl. Engagement requires the father's permission. 1 Corinthians 7:36, I've put it there in your notes in the New King James Version. Excellent translation. This is a difficult verse to translate, but I think the New King James has a very accurate rendering, and it's very similar to the King James, but I think this makes it even clearer. 1 Corinthians 7:36, but if any man thinks he is behaving improperly towards his virgin, that is his virgin daughter, if she is past the flower of youth, or she is of marriable age, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let them marry. And so the idea here is that the father, it's intrinsic in the verse, the father must give permission for the daughter to marry. So we need to teach our children that if a young man is interested in our daughter, he needs to come to the father. He needs to make his intentions known to the father, because at the wedding, the minister is going to ask who gives this bride to be married to this man. And that father, if he's alive and available, he will say, her mother and I do. It is the father who walks the bride down the aisle and gives her away. And so it is as if she's coming out of the nooks and the crannies of the protection of the great mountain of mom and dad, and being released to the protection of this man. Engagement also means that the woman must start thinking about leaving her parents. As I said, she's got to come out of the cliffs. Think about, my mom and dad are not going to take care of me anymore. This man will have sole responsibility over me. And Jesus, in quoting Genesis 2:24, he says this in Mark 10:7, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. That's the leaving and cleaving principle. In other words, the purpose in marriage, one of the goals, is to leave all of your dependence upon mom and dad. You cut the ties financially. You cut the ties. In some ways, even socially. You don't have the same relationship. You're no longer to submit to them as a child, but you are to honor them as one adult to another. And now you're cleaving. You're getting ready to cleave to a spouse, and you're going to be one flesh and start an independent household with your own finances and your own place to stay. And mom and dad are not to pay your rent or take care of your car payment or do this and that. You're to have an independent life together apart from mom and dad. That doesn't mean your wife doesn't have a close relationship with her mom. She's always going to have a close relationship with her mom and maybe her dad. And you should let her freely have that relationship. She needs to have that. She needs a woman in her life that is godly. But, ladies, you can know that a man is a man of honor and is willing to protect you later in life if during the courtship and the engagement, he carefully protects your purity. If he starts putting you in tempting situations, you need to consider that you might need to call it quits. Now, consider the pressures of engagement. Now, for all intents and purposes, they're engaged, because the very next chapter is the wedding. And we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. But verse 15, we find the pressures of engagement. He says, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards. For our vineyards are in blossom. The foxes are pests in the vineyard, these animals that wreak havoc in the vineyards. They eat the grapes before they've come to ripen. They take the little buds off the vines, and they cause problems. And there are many things in the engagement period where there are little foxes that spoil the vineyards. In order to have a deep growing love in marriage, you have got to focus your mind away from romance and onto godly things. Now, romance, there's nothing wrong with romance. God gave us romance. God is the author of romance. But it needs to be guarded and protected as the amazing, sacred thing that it is. You know, I think it'd be amazing for those who want to put their signature on that purity covenant, for those young men and those young ladies, those maybe their children now, one day to give that purity covenant to their spouse on the day of that wedding and say, I've kept myself pure for you. I'm yours and no one has touched me. I'm all yours. Fathers, it's your responsibility. Mothers, it's your responsibility to make sure that those two are not alone until their wedding day. It's your responsibility. Don't allow them to be alone. Unless you trust their flesh, don't allow them to be alone. You say, that's extreme. Great. Call it what it is. I'm extreme in protecting your daughter's purity and wanting them to have a relationship that is not founded on the temporary flares of romance. Now listen, when all the right things are put into place, romance is amazing. But it's reserved for marriage. And it's a bonus, it's not the foundation. So, there are many foxes that spoil the vine. Perhaps there's uncontrollable desire, passion. If that's going on, you gotta stop, kill that fox, so that they don't destroy the vineyard of your love. Passion will destroy your marriage in the future because it will bring questions into your mind. Well, if this person didn't protect me before we were married, how can I trust him to protect me now that we are married? He didn't think enough of me not to put his hands all over me. But now that I'm married, I don't know if I can really trust this man. And it takes a long time to rebuild. Now, you can rebuild trust. Amen? And with the grace of God, all things are possible. And He can make all things new. But there is a great amount of work to do if trust is broken. There's the fox, another fox that spoils the vine. The fox of mistrust and jealousy. And the thoughts that, well, this person is not of enough character that I can trust him. Well, if that's the case, you shouldn't be courting him. You shouldn't be engaged to him. Call off the engagement and wait until that person matures or wait for God to send you someone else. There's the fox of selfishness and pride because you will have arguments in engagement. In fact, the arguments escalate in engagement because now you're thinking, I'm going to be with this person for the rest of my life. And you start discussing very, very tender things and sometimes you don't handle it in the right way. And so you're going to have to get ready, men, to know how to say, I'm sorry. To say, will you forgive me? Can I just say this one thing? This is so important. You married men, when there is a disagreement between you and your wife, it's your job to seek reconciliation first. Even if she never seeks reconciliation, and you should never demand for her to seek reconciliation for you. You leave that with God. So these foxes that spoil the vine are those things that also spoil the marriage. If you don't have a heart, men, to forgive your wife and to be the first one always to pursue reconciliation when there's a disagreement, you're going to have a very weak marriage. If you want a strong marriage, men, you've got to be the first one always to seek reconciliation even if your bride never wants to reconcile. You reconcile. Even if she never confesses anything that she's done wrong, maybe she hasn't done wrong, maybe you've perceived it wrong, but leave that with God. Be a leader. Now, Fourthly, there's the passion of engagement. Look at verse 16. We're almost done. My beloved is mine and I am his. He grazes among the lilies until the day breathes and the shadows flee. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains. So the wedding is getting very close. The wedding is in chapter 4. And the passions for marital love are rising. And by the way, those are put there by God. There's nothing dirty about this at all. Why do you say that? Well, she is thinking about marriage. She's thinking about waking up in marriage. And yet, Solomon is like a graceful gazelle. He's gentle in the way he approaches her. He's strong in his convictions as a young stag on cleft mountains. And yet her desires are rising. What should we say to that? Well, that brings us to the purity of engagement. This is the hardest time to keep pure. Look at chapter 3 and verse 1. She has a dream. On my bed by night. Now, this is a very strong Hebrew expression. It means night after night after night after night. This is the engagement time. And she can't wait to get married. So night after night she dreams about him. She says, on my bed by night I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. So she's dreaming about all this. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. Oh, she's thinking about marriage. She's thinking about living with this man forever. This is a wonderful thing. But again, she wakes up and in verse 5 she says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Listen, that is a good sentiment to have as you look towards marriage. But you cannot allow it to get out of control. You see, a fire in a fireplace brings warmth and light to the house, a warm glow, and all can gather around it because it is a fire that is under control. But if you take the burning embers and those burning logs and you place them in the middle of your living room, for a little while you'll have light and warmth, but it will burn your whole house down because it's a fire that is not under control. God gave us the fire of romance in our heart. God put those desires in our heart. But we need to have the same sentiment of purity that this Shulamite farm girl had. Do not awaken it until that marriage covenant is put in order before God and witnesses. Don't awaken it. You'll have these passions, strong passions. So let me conclude with a few things. Next week we're going to talk about the wedding that God wants those who are engaged to have. But in the meantime, let me close with a few encouragements and warnings. First of all, if you're considering engagement, do not jump into engagement too quickly. If you are not very, very sure that this person is what they say they are, then you need to wait. Listen to godly people around you. Make sure that you are desiring marriage for the right reasons. Remember Proverbs 31:30. Let's read that. Proverbs 31:30. This is the reason you should marry. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. If your loved one, this one that you love, if they love Christ and they love the Word, that's why you ought to love them. Everything else is superficial. And you ought to esteem that person before you agree to an engagement with that person. You ought to think, this is the godliest girl I know. You ought to think, this is the godliest man I know, ladies. You ought to have that esteem of each other. And if you don't think that of that person, then you need to wait. Physical attraction is not a strong foundation. There's got to be consistency, godliness, biblical conviction. And if these things are not there, then look for the warning signs. Can your relationship survive misunderstandings, arguments, pressures in life right now? Because if your relationship can't survive that, and you're constantly going up and down, it's going to get a lot hotter in marriage. The pressures are unimaginable in marriage. Now, secondly, plans should be made quickly if you are engaged. The time for discovery of this person's character is done. When you have said yes to an engagement, you're saying, yes, I am positively, as far as I can tell as a human being, and according to all my godly counselors, that this is the right person and God is in this. Then you need to have a short engagement. I say, let the courtship crawl. Let it be slow, but let the engagement be fast. Because there are so many temptations, especially physically. And that's the time you can express your love. I love you. But be careful. Do not be alone. Let your first kiss be at the altar. And here's a word of advice to men. Get to know the girl's parents well. When I was engaged to Jill, Jill was 1,000 miles away. We didn't have a short engagement. Our engagement was 14 months. But she was in college. She was finishing her last year, so I didn't see her. So in that case, there was enough distance and busyness between us both that we never hardly ever saw each other. And during that time, I was able to spend a lot of time with Jill's parents. Can I just say this? If you're a man who is engaged to be married, get to know your parents, the parents of your intended. Get to know them. Spend time with them. The father is going to be like a gorilla because he doesn't like you because you want to marry his daughter. But it's all right. He'll get beyond that. What do you want? He's not really like that. He just is testing you, okay? And you should be afraid of him. But anyway, you need to spend some time with them because you're not just marrying the daughter, men. You're marrying her family. You're talking about spending holidays and special times together. And you need to get to know the family. And young lady, you need to get to know your intended's family as well. Get to know them because you're bringing two families together. Let me close by saying that the Bible tells us that we are betrothed to Christ. Paul uses that imagery. We're not in heaven yet. We've not yet consummated the marriage. The marriage supper of the Lamb has not taken place yet. We're betrothed. So keep yourself unspotted from the world. Do not compromise in your holiness. Have a close walk. Let the embers of revival in your life be strong. Because one day our beloved is coming back to bring us to that marriage. Walk closely with him until then. Because very soon, in the twinkling of an eye, there's going to be the last trumpet. There's going to be a wedding feast. And the bride and the groom will be together. Christ and the church, universal and triumphant, will be together for eternity. Oh, I'm looking forward to that day. Until then, married men, married women, show the picture of Christ in the church in your marriage. And in the engagement, protect each other from diminishing that picture.